From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Mental health care for children and youth is our focus today as part of our series this week on the mental health system in New Hampshire. And there's a lot to consider here. First, as another teenager went on another deadly shooting spree, this time in Texas, the governor of that state is calling for mental health screenings of students. We'll ask our guests about that. Also, how children fare in New Hampshire's mental health system, given severe shortages of counselors and a general lack of understanding about behavior. What's just kids being kids, and what's cause for concern? Let's hear from you. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call. The number is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. We have four guests in the studio. Erica Ungarelli is here, director of the Bureau for Children's Behavioral Health at DHHS. That's the Department of Health and Human Services. Erica, nice to see you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Also with us, Fern Seiden, school counselor at Thornton's Ferry Elementary School in Merrimack. She's on the Merrimack District Mental Health Committee. And Fern, good to meet you. Thank you also for your time.
Thank you.
And Lisa Provost is here. She's the mother of a teenage son who was diagnosed with bipolar disorder, anxiety, PTSD, autism, and other learning disabilities. And Lisa, really good to have you here. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
And also with us, Jody Lubarsky. She's a licensed mental health worker, director of Child, Adolescent, and Family Services at Seacoast Mental Health Center. And Jody, good to have you too. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
And Jody, I want to start with you. You have said that kids and teens' mental health issues are misunderstood. How so? What don't we get about children and teens' mental health issues?
Well, I think oftentimes when we look at behaviors, there's an assumption of what that behavior is. And when I think of a diagnosis like depression, it gets manifested very differently for children, adolescents, adults, and then for the gender specifically as well. And so we'll sometimes see a youth who appears very angry, irritable, withdrawing from people, not, you know, really engaging. And people will make this assumption that the youth is angry and start treating them to help them manage their anger or control it. And we'll miss that opportunity of really digging a little deeper and looking at what might be more depression rather than anger. For a lot of kids, those feelings of depression can be really unnerving. It's not something they've experienced before, and really don't know how to label it or how to seek help from others when they're feeling those depressive symptoms. So rather than always maybe showing more traditional signs of being tearful, crying, sad, the anger comes out because those feelings are so confusing, and we miss that opportunity to really treat the depression and in the meantime mistreat an anger issue and miss the opportunity to really support the youth. I think we see that with a lot of the diagnoses that our children and adolescents struggle with. We'll see kids in school settings who get labeled as oppositional, acting out, defiant. And when we dig a little deeper, we learn and find out that they're struggling with some anxiety. The anxiety may be around being around other peers, being expected to perform or present a task. And so the opportunity to have to engage in those activities that can be so discomforting for them, they'll instead use kind of escape tasks, what we'll call. You know, they'll start to become defiant, disruptive. Teachers will send them out of the classroom and they get relief because, you know, I've missed that opportunity to have to perform that math test. And again, we miss the mark of being able to treat and respond to an anxiety symptom, and we label it as opposition, acting out, a defiant child. And I think we see that with a lot of the diagnoses that children and adolescents struggle with.
Wow. So how do you figure it out? How do you separate what's oppositional or defiant or, you know, misbehaving and anxiety or depression?
I think we really look at the opportunity to work with all of our systems. I think very often we treat things in these silos and miss the opportunity to really connect with school-based staff, teachers, case managers, guidance counselors, administrators in the school, and then also talking to pediatricians. They've known many children since birth, sometimes responding when mother gives birth in the hospital, and that's where that relationship begins. And so other than the parent or the caregiver who really knows this child best, pediatricians, family physicians, school staff, and then coordinating with mental health specialists. I think working as a team to really look at what is potentially an anger management issue and addressing that truly as anger, but what might be depression or anxiety and what's really the root or the precipitant for those behaviors.
Wow. So to you, Lisa, given your personal experience, what do you think we don't understand? You, yourself, your family, your son's school, what don't we understand about kids' mental health issues?
Well, Jody made a few really good points that I also believe in. We treat in silos, and we send our children off to school, and they're there for a majority of the day. And those behaviors that we see and treat as oppositional or a problem are oftentimes a function of a deeper and more more complex situation going on, like depression or PTSD or autism. And so I think that we need to have a stronger and more rigorous collaboration between school, home, the medical profession, and our community-based supports in order to fully treat and fully deal with the children holistically. It's really difficult when you go into the psychiatrist's office because you're getting reports from the school and you're just so confused about, oh, what do I do now? And then we start on different medications and one thing leads to another and we create more symptoms and then all of a sudden, the root problem has been exacerbated. And I think that's part and impartial to a lot of the problems that we see and a lot of the confusion that parents experience because we look to the professionals to guide us. But really, we need to feel confident in the things that we're seeing and the type of research that we can do on our own to come up with some suggestions to the schools, to the doctors, and to the therapists to move forward. And really, we need to bridge the gap that exists between all those systems.
And it must be hard, Lisa, too, to not, initially anyway, get mad at your kid. You know, stop misbehaving in school. Stop getting in trouble. Stop acting out at home.
Yeah, it is. It's definitely hard. But you know, when you educate yourself on the possibility of these mental health issues or, you know, like my son is also diagnosed on the spectrum, you start to realize that, you know, these are functions of a behavior that you need to learn how to help that person manage. And that's frustrating. I think building a support system as a parent, you know, of professionals and people that you trust and that you can go to who also know and understand the situation is important. And I know we shouldn't talk about, you know, specific organizations, but NAMI is huge. Like
sure.
Everybody who has a child with this diagnosis needs support from NAMI.
Well, and that's the National Alliance on Mental Illness, and the head, Ken Norton, was here yesterday. And we also have a ton of resources on our website all week, by the way. So I just want to remind everybody to please check out our series web post all this week at nhpr.org because there are lots of resources like NAMI, as you said, and more information. And, you know, since Lisa mentioned schools, I did want to read this email that we got from Maria in Wolfboro and ask you, Fern, what you think about it since you work in a school. Maria says, please discuss school and community mental health programs. My son has autism. Addressing his needs with regard to anxiety and medication management is a great challenge. Maria says, special education can include psychological services, but I believe it is rarely provided. I also wonder about partnerships with schools and community mental health centers. Maria says this is also an area that is lacking attention in New Hampshire. So from your perspective, can you talk about that, Fern, the idea that you're working in a school and how much coordination or lack thereof is there with community mental health centers?
It's really different across the state, and that's something that I've, in talking with other counselors and with the state itself about what's going on in different areas. So in my area in Merrimack, we are still really establishing that relationship with our community mental health agencies, and it does take a lot of, you talked about silos and working about breaking down those silos between our agencies and really understanding that we're not going to be able to do this alone. We're trying to reimagine what it means to be a school in a community. And that means that we're breaking down those silos and reaching out across our borders. It's going to take that in order to meet this challenge, because really right now, the numbers of students with these mental health disorders and mental health challenges are really outstripping our ability to provide the care we need. We have to work as a system.
Can you talk more about that? That's interesting, because you said we're having to reimagine what it is to be a school, and it seems like you're seeing an increasing number of kids with mental health challenges in your school system.
Yes, we definitely are. We have been experiencing that for a while, and we recently, in the last 3 years, really started asking these really hard questions about, you know, how we were working and what we can do to best help students. Because really, you know, our challenge is that we are here to help kids be available to learn. So we can't, you know, pass the, you know, say, oh, it's a hot potato here, you catch it, community mental health agency, you take care of it, crisis team. If we do that, we are missing our opportunities to help our students. I believe, Jody, you were talking about that, those missed opportunities. And so as long as we don't sort of define this as a community-held responsibility, with schools being really a huge part of every community, we're going to miss those opportunities to help our kids, and they're all of our kids.
Well, and I can see you want to jump in, Jody, definitely since community mental health centers came up. But Eric, I do want to bring you in as well. People have talked already about silos and how those need to be broken down. Where are children these days, children and teens, getting their mental health treatment? I mean, who and what is this system that we're talking about?
Right. Well, at the department, there's many different child-serving organizations within the department. So there's a number of different places that children can get mental health services. And what we're trying to do at the department is to work in a more integrated way, like Lisa had brought up, which is necessary to not silo everything. So we are trying to work in a more integrated way. We are working with Department of Education to increase access to behavioral health services in schools and with our community mental health partners to do that as well. There are a number of community mental health centers that are partnering with schools to bring those services into schools. We're working at the state level with a number of different programs through the Department of Education to increase access in to mental health services in other schools across the state. So we are working to try and integrate more and have less siloed approaches to mental health services for children.
And I have heard at the state level, Erica, correct me if I'm wrong, that in some of these big, you know, plans and agreements and settlements, that children's health needs or mental health needs are often overlooked. Is that true?
That is true. Up until recently, I would say that's true. The last 10-year mental health plan did not include children.
Which seems amazing, given what, you know, we're hearing.
Right. And then the settlement that was discussed yesterday did not include children as well. Up until about 2 years ago, it really wasn't being paid attention to.
Why is that?
I think because adults in the mental health system, you're serving them for much longer. You're serving them from when they come into the system, really for the rest of their lives. So they're a bigger population. Children don't stay children forever. And so that can be missed. And has been overlooked for a number of years. Up until a couple of years ago, Commissioner Myers has really taken a renewed focus on that. And we're doing a lot of really great things right now to get that focus back on kids.
Well, Jody, go ahead, and then Lisa, I can see you want to jump in too. Go ahead, Jody. Community mental health centers keep coming up.
Well, and I think of Lisa's role as a parent and how challenging it is to navigate these systems sometimes,
right?
Because within our state of New Hampshire and amongst those 10 community mental health centers, the systems can look so different. We're delivering many of the same services to both the children and adults within the mental health care system, but yet it can look so different. You know, I can speak to our region that we're so fortunate to have really strong collaborative relationships with the schools within our community and have that opportunity to provide support to school-based counselors and psychologists and staff, because they're no longer just educators. They're now having to intervene in behavioral health issues as well. And that's what you will receive in our catchment of the state. And we're always adding another school each year to bring more services to the community in order to make sure that we're meeting those needs, making access easier, decreasing any barriers to getting care. And then yet you could go to another part of the state and maybe those relationships aren't fully formed yet, or how you access care is quite different. And so for both families and educators and other professionals within the communities who are working to collaborate with mental health care, it can at times be both frustrating and challenging, because you'll hear that you can get this service in need in this part of the state and maybe something that's not as well established in another part.
So, Jody, what do you say to people listening who might think, look, you know, a child's mental health is the responsibility of the family, the responsibility of maybe the community mental health system, or if you've got good private insurance, you know, maybe the child's therapist, that the schools have enough on their plate?
Well, I think some of those are all myths, because I think it's everybody's responsibility. Just because you have good private insurance doesn't mean you have easier access to good quality care. And so I think it can really vary. But I think across the state and across our systems, it's everyone's responsibility to make sure we're caring for the needs of children. The focus, as Erica stated, is oftentimes on adults. But I'll comment that the children that we're working with now someday become adults. And so why not intervene early, start providing some prevention and care? And so we start to reduce the episodes of care into their adult world rather than having to extend episodes of care into the adult lifespan.
And from what I understand, if you address some of these issues early, you can have a lot of success as that child moves into adulthood. Go ahead, Lisa.
Yeah. So when our children are in school, they're going to have a hard time accessing curriculum, because they need to, you know, they need to be treated on a constant basis every day for their mental health issues in conjunction with learning skills and academics. We have to bring that level of support and therapies into the school, not just with a school counselor, but with really qualified individuals who work probably in other organizations throughout the state. And you're right, Jody, as a parent, navigating the systems is absolutely a nightmare. I don't work out of the home. I'm a, you know, full-time mom. I can't imagine some of the parents who have to do these things during their work break. It's frustrating.
Wow.
So, we really need to do better with providing better access and supports.
Well, after a short break, we might hear a little bit more about your journey, how you did navigate it, how you came to a place where your son is doing better. We should for sure hear about that. And I can see others want to jump in too. That is great. Also, lots more emails that I'd love to share, including one from Jessica, who wants to talk about staffing at schools, and from Christine, who talks about difficulty accessing treatment. We'll take your calls to the number 1-800-892-6477. More in a moment.
You listen to NHPR day in and day out, month after month.
This morning edition on NHPR. Happy New Year.
As a sustaining member, your support is also ongoing and monthly.
This is All Things Considered. 4th of July celebrations are happening across
And because of sustaining members, we're able to put more funding into the programs you love and invest in future reporting.
Happy Labor Day. Midterm elections are just 2 months away.
Join the thousands of NHPR listeners who contribute monthly. Go to nhpr.org and click on Donate.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, in depth, mental health in New Hampshire. Our series continues with a focus on children, and we're talking with teachers, providers, and parents about how young people fare in the system. Let's get your questions, observations, personal stories in. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. And all of you, let's go to the phones. And Dave's joining us from Intervale. Hi, Dave. Go ahead. You're in the air. Welcome.
Hi, my name is Dave Lynch.
Okay, and great, Dave. Yeah, go ahead.
I'm a licensed clinical social worker in the state. And I was a little frustrated yesterday because some of your guests made it sound like the big problem was trying to attract more people to become clinical social workers. I think the real problem is twofold. One, there's inadequate funding in the state to support mental health programs, and two, the whole structure and the whole system is deeply flawed, and that the focus is on the community mental health centers, and they do the best they can. But the reality is, there's kids that are really, really struggling that have been in multiple residential treatments and hospitalizations and so forth that really need intensive home and community and school-based programs. But because they're really, and I actually work for a program that does that, and your guest earlier was talking about the need for partnerships between schools and mental health, and we do that. I work in the schools in my area, and the school district is phenomenal. They actually pay for the majority of the work we do, and the school district end up having to pay for the really extensive mental health services that are needed, but beyond a once-a-week outpatient in the community mental health centers, because there's just no infrastructure and support from the state to meet those needs, so the schools end up doing it.
Yeah, it needs to go deeper and broader, and I think that was the situation with you, right, Lisa? I mean, it wasn't enough to send your son to, appointments twice a week.
Oh, exactly. To Dave's point, I agree with that completely. My son has been hospitalized since the first time back when he was 11 years old, a total of 9 times.
Wow, it's so hard.
Sometimes for over a month. So it's been really difficult. The community mental health centers, in my area, I can't access some of the supports through them because my son uses a psychiatrist provider outside of that was established, years ago. And so there's got to be better rules and regulations as far as, how do we provide supports? Because some of those community mental health supports would be really beneficial for us. But we can't use them.
Well, and here's an email to that effect that you just made about, different rules and regs. And Erica, maybe I'll ask you about that. Someone sent us an anonymous email. Several public schools have increased their knowledge and prevention efforts, such as having staff be trained in youth mental health first aid and hiring school social workers who have their master's in social work. However, this person says, the New Hampshire Department of Education Bureau of Credentialing continues to create barriers for these trained professionals, many of whom are licensed. This person says, please fix. We did a whole show, Erica, on licensure and how it's keeping certain professions down. People want to join in, but it's too tough, or they can't quite make it. And I just wonder what you think about the comment that Lisa made and that this person makes.
Right. I do agree. There is complications with credentialing and licensing, and there's lots of different types of licensure and credentialing. They were talking about licensing and credentialing through the school department, but then there's the professional licensing boards for all the various levels of licensure and credentialing within the mental health profession. And there's not a lot of work being done crosswise in terms of rules and regulations to make that process easier. I know this is part of what we are looking at the department in order to affect the workforce issues we're experiencing. I do think there are workforce capacity issues, and it may be in part because of the licensing issues, but we're just not getting the folks where we need them to participate in the workforce.
Well, and from Dave's call, I want to ask you too, Fern, what you think. You know, it's great that Dave said he felt like his school district was doing a phenomenal job, to use his words, but it seems like he feels that the whole system needs to be richer and deeper. It's not enough to just, you know, send a kid to therapy once or twice a week.
Absolutely. I completely agree with that thought, that sentiment, that it's not enough. The one time a week appointment with a therapist is not going to help the child necessarily on a day-to-day basis. And so we've really started looking at, you know, what it is that we have to do in our school to really create what we're calling a system of care and learning supports, where everybody who has contact with a student has an opportunity to create kind of a buffering effect for that student. You know, we're not we are not offering therapy, but we can all offer therapeutic relationships, and that gets to the buffering effects of creating opportunities for attachment, for attunement, really teaching and modeling empathy and really listening and seeing children and listening to their experiences, that these aren't outside of the realm of education anymore. They're part of a teacher-student relationship. They're part of every relationship. Every school needs to be, you know, a place where kids feel seen and supported and nurtured for their whole, you know, that holistic sense of the child. And I think that's where we are learning a lot. We're doing a lot of, for us, it's really about digging in and doing a lot of professional development across the board for everybody who might have contact with a student. And we are working a lot with helpers in our, we call ourselves helpers. So anybody, so occupational therapists, school counselors, you know, PT, OT, everybody who's working with a student is a helper, behavior specialist. And we're working really hard to teach, because that really, we are actually learning so much even about the brain chemistry that it results from offering students these kinds of relationships on a day-to-day basis.
Sure. And we've heard so many times that if a child has one or two really positive, warm relationships with an adult at school, it can make a big difference. You said earlier, Fern, that you are seeing in your district and probably around the state more kids presenting with mental health issues. And I just wonder why you think that's the case.
I've thought a lot about that question, and I don't have, you know, the research or data to show that. But, you know, certainly times have really changed. You know, as our society changes, we see those changes in our schools. And so, you know, maybe there's, you know, a lot more influx of media and technology and the way kids are using those outside of schools. There's, you know, we've been living in a post 9/11 world now for quite some time, and that kind of, there are some real traumatic effects of being a country at war for a long time. So, you know, I've thought a lot about this, and I don't really have a real answer, but I do know that, you know, that children are, what we often look at are the behaviors. I think, Jody, you talked about how we see the behaviors in schools. We don't necessarily, we're not diagnosing them right off the, you know, that's not our job right away. But we're seeing this effect, and we know that we are definitely spending like 80% of our time as helpers, helping about 20% of the most needy students. And we've got to look at that and understand more about that.
Well, and we got a question from a listener who asks, why are more American teenagers than ever suffering from severe anxiety? And this person also sent us a link to a New York Times article on the subject. So, Jody, would you say that's true, that more American teens than ever are suffering from anxiety?
Again, you know, I'll kind of mimic what Fern said, and that I don't have specific research in front of me, but I would say anecdotally what we see within the practice as far as the calls that we get to our intake and admissions office for youth and family seeking treatment and for kids that we're seeing in care, we are definitely seeing higher numbers of anxiety amongst youth. And I love that somebody brought up youth mental health first aid, because I think it's a great model to use for everybody across our state. You know, it's essentially first aid for mental illness, and how you can better recognize the those signs in a youth and adolescents, and what are those steps that you can take to access the care that they need. So, when we reflect upon the statistics from that model, we start seeing anxiety present in kids as young as 8 years old, and we go to those preteen years, which can be the most difficult. And I think, again, what Fern said, we live in this world now where everything is more accessible. We're exposed to far more things than we ever were. Probably for everybody sitting around this table right now, we didn't have that instant exposure to world and life events. And I think it definitely creates more vicarious trauma for kids and anxiety and this sense of being unsafe in their world.
Vicarious trauma. What is that?
Just having a traumatic experience based on something else that someone else has experienced or you've seen. I remember years ago when I was doing home-based work back when 9/11 happened, and I would go into homes and families were watching the news on this constant loop. And within a few days, the kids would start to experience and discuss symptoms of feeling nervous and overwhelmed about leaving their house. Had no connection to anybody in New York City, but I think just that ongoing exposure to the event started to impact their emotional well-being.
Okay, didn't parents know better than to leave that thing running? I mean, it's anxiety-producing for everybody,
but especially
the young brain and the young spirit.
But now we live in this world where a child can pick up a phone and within 2 seconds and the click of a couple buttons have access to information and news that I think none of us ever believed they could.
Yeah.
And so I want to really hope that we're doing a better job. Back to that question of why are we seeing this more, I want to believe that even though Mental Health Awareness Month was created in 1949, that we're starting to break down that concept of stigma around mental illness, and we're treating it like any other illness, and we're doing a better job of identifying and diagnosing and providing the preventative care.
Well, and I appreciate what you say about the instant access after that terrible, terrible terrorist attack in Paris. I think it was a year or two ago. My younger son, who said, "Mom, what's Pray for Paris?" And I hadn't even heard about the attack yet, so I said, "What happened?" So he told me about this thing. So, and you have to think, all right, at that point he was, I think, 12. How is he processing that, you want to jump in. Go ahead, Lisa.
Yeah, it's true. The instant access to any number of pieces of information, news reports, good, bad, or indifferent, have a huge effect on us as parents, as, adults. But I mean, imagine kids.
The developing brain.
We right.
don't know what the impact is on that developing brain yet.
But, we need to get more creative and thoughtful on how we limit and design what's the right information to be looking at and what's the right time. But the other piece of that is technology is not going away. It's just going to become more and more available, and children younger and younger have more and more access to it. So the other piece of this is, let's look at the school system that our children sit in all day long. They live by a bell. They live by trying to fit in to the norm. And so, ring the bell, move to another class. You're like hoarded through the classroom. These types of things are also anxiety inducing or continue to, add to the anxiety. And so you take a kid who may have looked at the 9/11 footage on a loop when they were 9 years old. And by the time they're 16, with all of the structure in the school system, they're now on, anti-anxiety medication, right? So there's a lot we can do. We can break down the barriers of how we teach, how we manage these children, and how all these systems start to work together.
Here's a comment that we received from Jessica, who says, "I work as a school counselor, but I also have my CAGS, there's more of those acronyms in this field that you mentioned, Erica, in mental health counseling. I chose to get the advanced training due to the severity of mental health issues we're seeing in schools. However, even with this training, I am not able to work with students to the extent I would like due to a variety of reasons, caseload numbers, other school duty obligations, IEP, 504 meetings, again, more bureaucracy around this issue." And two questions. First, to you, I think, Fern, I'm wondering what the ideal number of people would be in your school. You talked about trying to help people and how you're trying to create those, you know, warm, caring relationships with kids to ease some of the mental health issues that they have. I mean, what would be ideal?
I don't know what is the ideal number. One thing I know is that if we hired a mental health counselor tomorrow to work in our high school or in our middle school or even in our elementary schools, that person's caseload will be fully booked the second they walk in the door. So it's hard for me to picture what that good number is. And that's why I think going back to and we actually came to that conclusion 3 years ago when we started our mental health committee. We said, you know, we were so anxious. We were like, yes, let's get things going here. We should hire some SAP counselors, student assistant program counselors, and need to do more with this and that and hire people. And the leadership of that group said, you know, let's slow down and let's really look at what this problem is. Let's find the gaps in our system. Let's find out the severity and let's slow our process down, because what we're looking at is culture change. It's not necessarily just hiring someone for a quick fix. And that doesn't mean that we don't hire people and integrate these programs that are being built in the Seacoast that we just heard about. And I know they're being built all over, these community coalitions that are working together to bring people together. But we also have to really look at what our schools can do on a broader basis to help. And just what you were saying about sort of look at the day, like look through the eyes of a child who has anxiety. Let's step back. What if we can have every adult in that school understand what it feels like for a bell to ring when you have a heightened stress response system that's been laid down for whatever reason, whether it's a biologically based problem or whether it has come from adverse childhood experiences? What does it feel like to be in a school, and how can we really listen to children, listen to parents, and incorporate that into our day? And even just increasing the level of understanding is going to change the quality of that school climate and culture to address this on a broader basis.
Yeah, it's a lot, though. I'm feeling for teachers. You know, they also have to follow the state standards and follow the local standards and, you know, make sure they get the kids to take whatever tests they need to take and, you know, learn about the Revolutionary War or whatever. So it's a lot.
It is a lot. But I think that what we have found is that when we form these relationships and when we are getting ahead of it, then we by using opportunities in the classroom to teach social emotional development skills and strategies and, incorporating, there are people doing incredible work with mindfulness and yoga in the classroom and teaching kids self-regulation strategies. When we do that, we're more likely to be able to get to those topics.
Then you don't have to take time out because somebody is acting out and you can't teach the Revolutionary War. Erica, I'm really struck by what Fern says about, you know, if we hired a counselor tomorrow, that person would be booked the next day.
Right. Caseloads are always a big topic, whether it's at school or within the community mental health centers. And I don't have any magic number, but I do know it's based really on the level of need of every individual child. Lower the case numbers, the better the connection, the better the in-depth work. At the highest level of acuity, we try and keep caseloads to about 8 to 10 per individual person working with that group of children.
All right. Lots more to talk about after a short break. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow, our series continues with a look at the intersection of our mental health and criminal justice systems. That's tomorrow in The Exchange. Today, the focus is on children and teens and their mental health experiences. And let's hear from you on that topic. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-9898. 6477. We have four guests with us. Erica Ungarelli is here, Director of the Bureau for Children's Behavioral Health at the Department of Health and Human Services. Also with us, Fern Seiden, school counselor at Thornton's Ferry Elementary School in Merrimack. She's on the Merrimack District Mental Health Committee. Also with us, Lisa Provost, a mom of a teenage son who was diagnosed with bipolar disorder, anxiety, PTSD, and autism. She's been sharing her stories. And also with us, Jody Lubarski. She's a licensed mental health worker and director of Child, Adolescent, and Family Services at Seacoast Mental Health Center. One more time, that number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. And let's go next to Deli in Concord. Hi, Deli. Go ahead. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, Laura. Thanks. While I work for the Children's Behavioral Health Collaborative, I'm actually calling in as a parent. My son was diagnosed with a serious and persistent mental illness 10 years ago, and I am so jealous of the services that people are receiving today.
Wow.
We didn't have wraparound services 10 years ago. The system has improved greatly. We still have a lot of gaps. We still have a lot of work to do. But I was hoping that Erica wouldn't mind letting parents know about the coordinated efforts that are in place today because of the system of care law. I think parents need some hope, and they need to know that wraparound services are prevalent or could be more prevalent, but are existing in our state, and I would love for her to touch upon that topic.
Well, Deli, thank you, and hope is always a welcome addition to this conversation. So go ahead, Erica, please.
Sure. Thanks, Deli, for the question. So there are a lot of things changing right now in children's mental health. So one of the callers discussed about intensive community-based services, and that's one thing we have been able to develop over the past 5 years is an intensive program for children with high needs to serve them in their home. The child and their family get to drive what is happening, what services they need, and at what time that they need them. We use a model called New Hampshire Wraparound, which ensures that that child and that family are driving the services and that they get the intensive in-home supports that they need to have that child be successful in the home, in the community, and at school. So it uses a team approach. I think both Fern and Lisa talked about a team approach and that the family and child gets to identify their team members. School is a part of that. And so that's a really intensive community-based program that we're able to expand right now. And we're looking to replicate that in other areas. I know we're working with certain schools and the Department of Education to replicate that sort of service array in the school as well.
Well, Deli, thank you for the call. Let's take another one. This is Molly in Andover. Hi, Molly. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I had a daughter. I have a daughter right now. And when she was in preschool, she was almost asked to leave the program because of her intensive behaviors. And when I tried to get services and have her evaluated, I was on a waiting list for 6 to 12 months at both Dartmouth-Hitchcock and Boston Children's. And I just called this morning again to see if that wait list has changed. Again, I need to update their evaluations. And again, it's still that same amount of time, anywhere between 9 and 14 months just to be evaluated. And that I need those evaluations in order to, well, one, get medications, two, have an IEP in place for the school to address their needs. So, you know, if you can't get evaluated, you can't access.
Right. So what are you supposed to do in the meantime, Molly?
It was very, very difficult. You know, my child's behaviors were almost unlivable. You know, we just, you know, had to hold tight and wait and get a lot of family support. And in addition, some of the services that were recommended weren't covered then by our insurance. For instance, ABA services is only approved for children with autism and not for children with ADHD or other diagnoses. So
and sometimes kids have a variety of issues, Molly. So it's again, we keep talking about silos. We keep getting back to that. And Molly, other parents have had the same struggles, as I'm sure you know. Christine sent us a note. She says children with significant mental health needs are not able to access services in a timely manner. Children have the equivalent of a behavioral 104 degree temperature for extended periods of time but cannot receive care. No child, Christine says, would be left with 104 temperature for weeks and not get medical care. How can we create more immediate and community-based services? And I want to throw that one to two of you. Jody, you first, from your perspective as a community mental health provider, but then also Lisa, obviously, from your experience as a parent. So go ahead, Jody, please.
Well, it really, I think, comes back to the comments that the previous caller, Dave from Interville, made. And I think we definitely have a professional shortage across the state. It's quite difficult, I think, to attract new professionals to this field when their livable wage isn't something that they can survive off of. Most providers are still being reimbursed at rates based on 2006. And so when you're trying to, I think, provide a salary to your staff that affords them a livable wage, living in New Hampshire is not always affordable for many of our professionals. We need to look at how we improve our system. If you want to attract more professionals to the field, we have to make sure that this is a field people want to go into and that they can survive in. And I think as we do that, as we build a more robust mental health system in New Hampshire, both in community mental health, within our schools, within private practice, and in physical health settings, we then can provide the care to children and adolescents that we want to in a more timely manner.
Go ahead, Lisa. Your thoughts, too, on this waiting. I'm sure you can relate.
Well, my son wasn't diagnosed with autism until he was 14. Everything else was behavioral until then. And what's really awful for me is that when he was about 18 months old, I suspected that he was on the spectrum, and I brought it up to the pediatrician and was told that I was just a neurotic parent. So, you know, and then all of the other, you know, symptoms of other types of illnesses that mimic a lot of the things that go along with that autism diagnosis kind of creeped in. And so I really feel for the caller who's waiting on the on, you know, her evaluations. There's got to be a better way. And, you know, I would just continue to try and put my child on a wait list, no matter what, you know, everywhere. At this point, just keep, you know, making appointments and, you know, take the first one. I, too, was on a wait list at Boston Children's, Dartmouth. My son wasn't diagnosed with autism until he was an inpatient at Brattleboro Retreat for over a month. So
did that diagnosis of autism sort of open a window for you where you were able to, you know, I mean, it's not a diagnosis anybody wants,
no,
but at least you have
really
it, and then you can kind of understand everything else from there.
Well, I kind of did. I kind of already knew it. We just never were able to get those ABA supports that he should have had growing up.
And ABA is what?
Is the applied behavioral.
Gotcha.
Piece that really, you know, is fundamental in those early years. So when your child's 14 and they're diagnosed, you kind of, it's not as effective from what I'm understanding of the data that's put out there on ABA. So that would have changed a lot of the behaviors earlier on. But, you know, it is what it is. And I think for parents, you know, you're at where you're at. And there are some really great services through the state. And, you know, we just have to be really persistent about going after those.
Erica, do you want to jump in?
I do. One thing I want to comment on is the importance of infant and early childhood mental health. I think the caller and Lisa both brought this up that, you know, children experience difficulties very early on, at a very young age, and it's often missed more than that of older children. And it's a real gap in New Hampshire. Looking at the younger kids, having providers that are trained and competent to assess infants and very young children. A lot of it can get mixed up in appropriate developmental stages, which we already talked about.
Now, how do you know, kids being kids? I mean, most 3-year-olds are going to be, you know, defiant and difficult.
Right. There is a standard of practice and training that we are looking at to bring to New Hampshire to spread throughout the provider community so that we do have providers that are competent and capable of assessing and working with early childhood and infants to assess appropriately, make sure that if they have a diagnosis, that it's an appropriate diagnosis at such a young age. There's a real reluctance to diagnose children at a very young age.
Sure, which is understandable.
It is understandable. But as we've already discussed here earlier, things can get missed. And the earlier you identify and provide services, the less of the impact and to the child and the family.
Are some of these mental, getting to that early piece, are some mental health issues, Jody, if they are caught and treated early, are they quote unquote curable?
Well, absolutely. I mean, one of the statistics that we provide during youth mental health first aid training is 90% of mental illnesses are treatable. And people often ask, well, what about that other 10%? And it's not that those 10% aren't treatable. They're just often complicated by maybe an underlying medical issue that has to be treated and addressed first before you can really get to the work of the mental health diagnosis. Laura, when you asked Lisa the question, did that diagnosis change things? And I think about that in a more broader sense. It certainly has to change the treatment pathway. You know, we talked earlier about how oftentimes diagnoses are confused for other symptoms and behaviors. And if you have a child who's truly dealing with anxiety and we're treating it as opposition because they're, again, using their behavior to escape those tasks they're anxiety provoking, we're not providing the appropriate treatment pathway. And we're potentially letting things go 2, 4, 10 years before we finally get to a place of appropriately addressing it. And Lisa's absolutely correct. Then you're undoing all these years of work and behaviors that have begun to cement themselves and trying to change those. And unfortunately, it doesn't change overnight, and it becomes harder work for both the family, the youth, and the professionals who are collaborating with them.
Well, and we talked earlier about anxiety and some of the anxiety-producing elements of the typical school day. I think you mentioned that, Lisa and others. And Marty sent us an email. He says, hard to believe that nobody has brought up active shooter drills as well as monthly news of yet another school shooting. Yes, Marty, we absolutely should talk about this. And I wonder, you know, for instance, you work with kids in an elementary school, how these active shooter drills, how this just terribly disheartening trend that we're seeing of school shootings becoming so frequent, how is that affecting the mental health of the kids that you work with?
Well, we've been talking lately about making sure that when we conduct any kind of drill, that we're doing it in a way that is, the term being used now is trauma sensitive, that we are really understanding that kids are coming into our school with all different levels of resilience and abilities to cope with stress. And so whenever we are going to move forward to conduct a drill of any kind, that we're going to think very clearly and proactively about, okay, what systems do we have in place to help children cope with that? So that's really an important piece of this. I mean, active shooter drills, we are taking a very slow and thoughtful approach to that. That's not something I think we as a district are just jumping into and just, you know, running into that without thinking. We're going to think really clearly about how we go about doing that with our, and we really have great partnerships with our local police force, and we will do that with great care because that can be definitely a very traumatizing thing.
And it's traumatic enough to hear the news, yeah, and then to go through the drills time and time and time again.
Absolutely.
You got to wonder what's going on in
fire drills, which we've done, you know, forever, are traumatized. You know, they're loud and there's a lot of people and they're going, you know, we're doing something all at once together as a big group as fast as you can. That's traumatizing enough. So it's really important that we think very hard about, you know, what we're doing in school. School should not be a place where kids are being re-traumatized. And we really have to look at that and be very thoughtful and
Well, Marty, I really appreciate the point. Did you want to jump in too, Jody, on that?
I think just removing my professional hat and putting my parent hat on, you know, I applaud my daughter's school for the level of communication that they've offered around the drills, because it's certainly not an easy thing to talk about, whether as a professional or as a parent. And I think it really essentially goes back to that communication and collaboration and making sure that schools and families and communities and all those higher levels of professional care are working together so we can literally wrap ourselves around our children and provide the support that they need in order for them to leave really healthy, resilient lives as they grow.
Well, Marty, thank you again for the email. We really appreciate it. And Lisa, I did want to just ask you how your son is doing now. You've described the journey, the hospitalizations, the difficulty getting a diagnosis. I can't believe someone told you you were a neurotic mom when you were just trying to do the best for your son. But we'll set that aside for now. How's he doing? Well, and what kind of helped you turn the corner?
Well, there's, in certain ways he's doing much better, and other ways he's not. So he's really falling behind academically, but socially he is starting to come into his own, and so some of the things that really have helped Michael. Oops, I shouldn't say that. after school program. So he's involved with an after school program that works towards doing community projects and helping other individuals.
Oh wow! So sort of reaching outside his own problems.
So things like that are mixed in with peers who are neurotypical and are very welcoming and supportive, and that has really helped him shine. So, so that's been helpful. And you know, we're just working hard on the trying to find the right methodology to deliver academics for him. So,
well, we really appreciate you being here today, and good luck with him.
Thanks.
Thank you so much. That's Lisa Provost, again, mom of a teenage son. She's told us about her efforts to go through the system to help her son out with his mental health issues. Fern Seiden, it was really good to meet you, too. Thank you very much. Fern Seiden, school counselor at Thornton's Ferry School, an elementary school in Merrimack. Erica, good to see you. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Erica Ungarelli, director of the Bureau for Children's Behavioral Health at DHHS. And Jody Lubarsky, nice to meet you, too. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you, Laura.
Jody Lubarsky, she's director of Child, Adolescent, and Family Services at Seacoast Mental Health Center. Again, a reminder to everybody, check out our series web post all this week as we look at the mental health system here in New Hampshire. It's at nhpr.org.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.